Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Across New England, students and families are looking at colleges, and they're facing a new worry. Will the school where I enroll even exist by the time my child graduates? This is spurred by a series of small college closures. Mount Ida College abruptly closed last year, then Newbury College in Brookline, followed by three schools in Vermont. So how should we be thinking about this new landscape? All this week, WBUR has been taking a closer look at the challenges facing small nonprofit schools as part of a series called Small Colleges, Big Challenges. Here to discuss is Michael Horn. He's the co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute, a nonprofit think tank, and his new book is called Choosing College: How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us on the line is Casey Neer. She's the Newton-based executive director of counseling at CollegeWise, a college counseling company. Casey, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you, call us. Do you have children looking at colleges? Are you worried about the stability of small schools in the region? Or do you work for a small school or do business with one and it's on your mind? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, Michael, first, you study the business of higher education. Why are these closures happening?
Yeah, so fundamentally, these business models that underlie small schools are breaking at the seams. We have costs increasing year over year over year, driven by administrative costs, services that they're providing going up, and just basic salary adjustments constantly increasing. And at the same time, you have families that just can't keep up with these revenue increases. We see tuitions going up year over year over year, but what people don't know is that the discount rate, meaning what people actually pay, is not going up nearly as fast. So colleges are not actually bringing in nearly as much revenue. And the costs are just exceeding the revenue, and it's putting these budgets at stress. On top of that, in New England in particular, we're just starting to enter a demographic cliff where there's going to be far fewer high school graduates in the years ahead, which is just putting a lot of stress. Fewer students, inability to pay the costs that underlie these schools, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Okay, so my heart is racing even just listening to you lay it out that way. Now, there is so much that goes into choosing a school. You interviewed a lot of students, a lot of parents for this new book. I got to believe that actually this hasn't even factored in, but maybe I'm wrong. Is factoring in the school's short-term viability even part of most people's process?
You're 100% correct. We talked to well over 200 students in making this book, creating essentially mini documentaries of their choice, and no one mentioned this. Literally zero students mentioned it. I think it's starting to change slightly among parents. Hampshire College in particular, when they announced that they were looking for a merger last year, I think that just sort of went on people's radar. You know, they had heard of Mount Ida, they had heard of Newbury, but Hampshire has this sort of iconic status in the New England landscape, and I think that started to get some parents' attention. So my sense is that's starting to change, but not really still. It's not really what students are looking at when they're thinking about getting into school.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you'd like to join the conversation, Casey, I got to believe you hear all kinds of anxiety from the families you counsel. It's an anxious process. Is this one of the items on the list for them?
I mean, I agree. I think listening to all of that had my heart racing. And I deal, you know, pretty much 24/7 in parent and teen anxiety, which is already through the roof with standardized testing and pretty much everything else. I think, you know, the short answer is frankly no. I think agreed that there is probably not as much focus on some of these, you know, the fiscal stability of some of these places. But I also think that a lot of anxiety oftentimes in this process comes from this notion of scarcity, that, you know, there's not enough options. There's not enough spots to go around, whether we're talking about highly selective schools or places that might be potentially closing. And the reality is, in my view, this is still a consumer or student, you know, landscape in the sense that there are still over 2,300 schools. And I do think that it's important for families to recognize that it would be bad counseling for me to tell a family, great, apply to one college. Maybe it'll close in 6 months. That's not a good idea. I think any kid needs to be applying to a broad range of colleges and then comparing a broad range of acceptance letters and financial aid packages and discount rates and all of the things, then making an astute decision. I don't want families thinking, oh my gosh, what if my kid gets into one school and that school closes? We can avoid that. That's a solvable problem.
Is there anything
there big problems?
Yeah. Is there anything about the way that you advise families that has changed since first Mount Ida, then Newbury College, then Hampshire is on thin ice, et cetera?
In the day-to-day, frankly, not yet and not really. I think the reality is that that is one of the factors that students should be considering when looking and making final decisions of, is this a place that I can thrive and kind of, you know, succeed in? And if it's a place that's not aligned and doesn't feel like it's a good match on a lot of levels, then I'm not going to counsel a kid to go there. But I don't think that it's come up, frankly, and I don't know that it changes the way in which most kids are going to engage with this process in the short term.
Michael, Casey talked about a good match there, and there is this sense that these small nonprofit universities in the New England region are of a certain type, and that that certain type is both storied and valued. So what gets lost as an option for families when these types of institutions face financial threat?
Yeah, what's so interesting about this that a lot of reporters love to push me on is that this small private college closure crisis really only affects roughly 5% of students that go to college. Most students go to public institutions that are significantly larger, or community colleges and the like. It's a minority of students that go to these smaller schools. But I think what that misses is exactly what you're pointing to, which is that this is an option that is very distinct from those large public schools where you can get lost in a sea of faces. And people like that picturesque experience. They like that personalization, getting to know your faculty members and professors and other students around the campus in a small, intimate environment. And I think one of the challenges facing American higher education right now is that a lot of institutions are in a race to all look the same. And actually, the strength of American higher education historically has been the diversity of choices that we have. And so losing these options, I think, in the landscape, it definitely loses something. It loses an option that is important for parents and students to be exploring.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you worried about us losing a type of college in our landscape with the closing of these small bucolic nonprofit colleges in New England? Do you think the system's broken? Is the model broken? Are you looking for something different as you think ahead to your kids, or maybe you have kids in the higher education system now? Casey, the state legislature is considering a bill that would make colleges have to disclose certain financial information in an effort to create more transparency. I would think, you know, supporting discerning families, that's attractive. But some are pushing back, saying, hey, you make us do that, you may cause a rapid withdrawal of students and investments that will force us over a tipping point to close. How do you, as a voter but also a professional, think about legislation like that? And what do you think the right balance is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question. And I think part of it comes back to this notion that I think colleges and people aren't often aware of this. When I worked in admissions, and I think there's a lot more transparency now with recent coverage of how many stakeholders there are in an institution, the amount of people that have a say, for better or for worse, in the class of students that ends up getting admitted, the amount of stakeholders at play. There is a lot of, I think, both transparency and people in the room to try and make sure that college is sustainable. I would actually flip this, and I actually think what needs a lot more regulation is the for-profit college industry. And I know that's not what necessarily we're talking about, but that's an area where I see the kids who are most affected by these closures, which are low-income students, Pell Grant recipients that are then pushed into for-profit institutions, and then lenders. I think those are two areas that need a lot more regulation. I don't know that I would push as hard at the nonprofit schools that we're talking about that are accredited and go through a lot of transparency already.
Michael, let me just ask you for your reactions to that. I noticed at one point you actually even chuckled, so let me just let you pick it up for a
minute. I guess the big thing, I agree. I think in terms of, fundamentally this mindset among students has to shift to not just trying to get into a school, but actually choosing the right fit. I guess the pushback I would have is I think more transparency for students to make an informed choice at the end of the day is a really good thing, and we should remember that the entities that authorize and govern our institutions of higher education, their purpose is to serve the students, not the institution. And so giving that more information, I think, is important. And I would push back a little bit on just regulating the for-profits. I think that's important. But the for-profit sector has been shrinking quite a bit over the last decade. I think we ought to look at all institutions equally and make sure that there's enough information so that students can make smart decisions for their circumstance.
All right, I have to go back because I'm distracted by this question that just keeps playing in my head as I hear the two of you speak. And Casey, I think something you said launched it for me. You both are so calm and relaxed about this whole situation, about the availability of schools for people, et cetera. And yet families, as they're going through this process, live in this psychotic pressure cooker world that suggests that you're never going to get in anywhere. Your child's never going to be able to afford a house, and that one might be true, and that you have to jump through 17 hoops, and it's incredibly scarce, and a closing of a college is going to end the future of some certain percentage of young people. I don't hear either of you saying any of that, so what's the deal? Where's the disconnect there? Casey, maybe you first.
Oh, gosh, yes. Where to begin? I mean, I think, like I said at the beginning, I do think that understandably our brains are attuned to outliers. We love it every year in our counseling profession to wait for the inevitable, you know, story about the kid who brokered peace between two nations and saved, a kitten from a tree and had a perfect GPA and they didn't get into Harvard, right? And the end of the story is always, and they have to go to Duke. and this notion that even these kids can't get in, right? And the reality is the vast majority of kids, they can go to college. There are plenty of issues in terms of access to higher ed for low-income students, but the median acceptance rate for college these days hovers around 68%. The vast majority of colleges admit the vast majority of their applicants. That's not a story we talk about. But if you want to go to college, you can. Now, if you want to pay and retain, we have actual problems. But if we're talking about access to higher ed in terms of getting in, that's not actually a story. I think we fixate on it because it's scintillating, but it's not actually a problem. There are plenty other problems.
So, Michael, does that mean that the financial model for most institutions is also still working?
So first, I totally agree with Casey, just to make the point that we've told this story around scarcity, and there's really only under 100 institutions that are truly scarce in terms of that they are very highly selective and they limit who they enroll. Even those writ large are arguably easier to get into today. Not maybe the one school, but one of the schools. It's never been easier. In terms of the financial models, I think those elite schools, they're on sound footing. I think the large public flagship universities, they're on sound footing as well.
Give an example. Just is that
so
like
the Ohio State, okay. You know, UMass, Amherst, they're fine, right? But I actually think if you start looking at small regional colleges, for example, if you go into Pennsylvania and look at their small regional colleges that are in Harrisburg and regions like that, they're actually at threat as well. And so it's sort of if you look outside those top 200, top 300 schools, there are a lot of institutions right now that are at peril of collapse. It's not just the small private liberal arts schools, although those are certainly driving the headlines right now. But if you look at religious schools, for-profit schools, and so forth, there's a lot of consolidation going on.
All right, let's take a call. David from Framingham is on the line. David, you're welcome to join the conversation.
Thank you. So there's a couple points that I'd like to make. One is the absence of governance in these boards, where if there is a financial viability issue, that it's clear that either they're not equipped or they're often poorly able to communicate that message and take the appropriate action. The second piece is, as someone who's interacted with the educational system in Europe, in Australia, as well as the United States, I do see an overabundance of small colleges here relative to other developed countries, which is surprising considering the market dynamics here.
So I'm curious. Wait, David, why are you surprised?
Well, given the fact that so much of our infrastructure is focused on, you know, channeling students to basically the highest ranking schools, right?
Got it.
The rankings
okay.
matter a lot in the United States. It's surprising that these schools have been in business over the last 20 years to begin with.
Okay, so let me pick it up from you there, David, and give our guests an opportunity to respond to what you've said. Michael, what's your response for David's
point? Yeah, so I think the board's point is a huge point, that a lot of boards have not been active enough to ask the difficult questions much earlier than before a school goes into crisis mode. And they have to get way more educated about this. It's one of the reasons I think that regulation from the state could help, because it could be an early warning sign to the institution and the board members that actually we have a larger problem here. We have some concerns looking at your financial sustainability. And before we alert students, let's actually have a conversation among the board members and the State Department of Higher Education, and then figure out a go-forward path. In terms of the disproportionate number of private institutions in the United States, it's actually more acute in New England. If you go out to the western part of the country, Arizona, California, and so forth, there's actually many more public institutions than there are privates, relatively speaking. And so I think it's a fair characterization or way to think about it that maybe the closures we're seeing is sort of a the New England coming into line with the rest of the country, let alone the rest of the world. That's an interesting read of it. I think that's fair.
Okay. Earlier today, we spoke with Rodolfo Aguilar. He's a parent and an organizer with Massachusetts Parent United. He's got one kid in college and two that are going to start looking at school soon. And he told us that he's actually recently started trying to look into the financial health of prospective colleges. Here he is.
Before, I was not thinking in how the financially this institution was doing. Today, I have to make sure that my kids are going to go to a school, that in the process, that the school is not going to close and put them in a disadvantage. I don't want to put that burden or that anxiety on my kids' education.
So, Casey, no parent obviously would want that burden or anxiety for their kid. If a parent that you were advising said, give me a couple of things I can do to kind of assess the health of the institutions my kids are applying to, or maybe my kid got in somewhere, I want to make sure they're solid, what's something you might advise?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very fair and understandable concern. I think one piece is that I think one is recognizing that oftentimes the fiscal viability, and there's always Moody's ratings and credit scores, and those often aren't always a tell. I think one thing I always look for is, what's the retention rate? How many students are actually graduating? They are required to release their six-year graduation rate percentage.
Where would a parent find that, Casey?
They can find that on Big Future, which is part of College Board. They also have common data set, which is something they all have to release. You can also just Google, you know, Northeastern six-year graduation rate or Northeastern retention rate. One thing I would caution is that oftentimes retention rates are lower for schools and unfortunately so, who have a high percentage of Pell Grant recipients, of low-income students, because they stop in and start in to pay for college. But that is one way to go. Is this a school that's not just admitting students, but actually graduating them? That's an incredibly important statistic to know.
Okay, Michael, in our last minute, is this the beginning of a kind of a much larger disruption in the four-year college model?
I think it is. I think we're going to see a lot of these closures happening across the Midwest as well, Ohio, Michigan, and so forth. And we also have, we haven't talked about it, but there's this other force of online learning coming in. I don't think it's going to replace the brick-and-mortar campus experience by any means, but I do think that it will start to pair itself with brick-and-mortar campuses in innovative ways that'll create lower-cost options. Think of Warby Parker instead of Macy's.
Warby Parker being the glasses manufacturer.
The glasses manufacturer, and they've got retail all around Boston now, and they're very small footprints, and they let you try it on, let you socialize with the employees, but they don't carry the huge inventory in these huge opulent campuses. I think we'll see something similar.
Michael Horn, co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute, a nonprofit think tank. His new book is called Choosing College, How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Casey Neer, a Newton-based executive director of counseling at CollegeWise, a college counseling company. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.